Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 264, we are pleased to bring you the preview of the November edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician is available online and in print, online at retinalphysician.com. That's RetinalPhysician.com. Doctors Daniel Chow and Yoshihiro Yanakawa join me for this episode. We discuss several topics. We start with a discussion of gene therapy applications for retinal disease, especially diseases regarding retinal angiogenesis. Next, we share some pearls regarding pediatric retinal disease. And then we move on to conversations about surface irritation after intravitreal injections in the retina clinic, as well as simulators for choroidal melanoma. As always, you can find this episode on our website with all the other episodes at retinapodcast.com. The episode description will have information on financial disclosures for all the contributors, and there's also a link to claim CME credits on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply click on the link and follow the instructions at the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be back and joined by two of our friends from around the country. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Daniel Chow from San Diego, California. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Jay. Always a pleasure.
Next, the most powerful alliterative name in all of retina, Dr. Yoshihiro Yanakawa from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Yoshi, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Though Shlomo Chal called, and she says that you may have something to take up with her because she may win the alliterative name game with you. So we are going to do the November edition of Retinal Physician. We're recording this in October. And as always, these articles can be found online at retinalphysician.com. And the goal of this is, again, not to summarize the articles. The articles are available online for you to read for free. So if you listen, you want to read more, you can go read those articles. We're going to use them as jumping off points for discussion. As always, thanks to the Retinal Physician team for providing the articles in advance of publication so we can take a look and decide what we think is interesting to talk about. So the first article we're going to talk about was a peer-reviewed article by Michael Lamar and Julia Haller. It's called Genome Editing and Gene Therapy to Treat Angiogenesis. The subtitle, New Developments Have the Potential to Change the Way Retina Specialists Treat Disease. So they go a little bit through the history, starting with Luxturna, which has been discussed extensively in this podcast, but Voretigene used to treat Leber's congenital amaurosis, as well as RPE65 retinal dystrophy mutations. And they talk a little bit about the importance of this, right? We have a lot of angiogenic-driven diseases, especially neovascular AMD and proliferative diabetic retinopathy, that cause a tremendous burden, a visual burden. And even though we have treatments for them, they're not optimal for certain reasons, such as durability, and need to come in for treatment. So they go through kind of things we've talked about before, the active gene therapy trials for wet AMD, including Regenix Bio, as well as Adverum, which is the subretinal route or intravitreal injection route. They talk a little bit of Humira. We've also talked about this on the podcast. And the thing I want to spend a little more talking about is this idea of CRISPRs. And Dan, I'm going to ask you about CRISPRs, or CRISPRs, because I always hear this term and I feel really smart to say CRISPRs. And then I read about CRISPRs and I feel really dumb because I don't really quite understand what's going on there. But they seem really promising. Everyone's telling me, oh, CRISPRs are the way to go. And so it seems like something I'll repeat. I'll say, hey, CRISPRs. But I don't know if I or some of the listeners necessarily understand what CRISPRs are. So let's start with that, Dan. What are CRISPRs exactly? And why are they important when we talk about the future of treating angiogenic retinal disease?
Sure. So first, I even had to look up the what the acronym stands for, because, of course, we're all using CRISPR this, CRISPR that, vice CRISPR treats. But CRISPR stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. And just to give a little bit of history, is that essentially what some biologists found was there were these short repeats, like a palindromic repeat, so it's like a word like radar or such, but with the nucleotide sequence. And people were always wondering why are these here? And essentially, it turns out that bacteria have a mechanism which is related to this CRISPR-Cas9, in that this Cas9 enzyme would essentially cut up viral genomes, and then these pieces would actually get inserted into the genome as a type of memory for these viruses. And so it'll act as kind of an antiviral strategy and mechanism. And of course, this was completely out of the blue. No one really knew that this existed until relatively recently. And the Nobel Prize was awarded to Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier for kind of describing this mechanism and showing that this works in non-mammalian cells, and that it could be used to engineer the genome. And the reason why people are so are excited about it and the way that it works is this idea of genome editing. So just to describe briefly what it is that there's a piece of DNA called the guide RNA. It will bind a specific sequence, and then there is this enzyme called Cas9, which will then cut the genome in that specific place. And when that happens, then there's a variety of things that you could do to edit that genome. You could add in some bases. You could take out some bases. You could replace them. And so then the idea is that it's really like kind of cut and pasting in your computer to change the DNA and perhaps correct various genetic diseases. Now, you know, I think as we'll talk about, I think we're still a long ways before realizing that reality. You know, what's very exciting about the eye is that this clinical trial with Editas and Allergan is the first use of this CRISPR-Cas9 in the body. And so what they're doing is they're injecting this vector that has this guide RNA sequence as well as the Cas9 protein to cut out a very specific mutation in this gene called CEP290, which is associated with a form of Leber's congenital amaurosis. And it's actually involved in this, it's a very specific mutation. It's not for all mutations in CEP290, but it's a specific single base pair mutation that causes a aberrant splicing. So instead of the exon being spliced normal, there's an abnormal exon that gets in there. And so what this vector does is it recognizes that aberrant splice site and cuts it out to then allow for normal gene production. And I think it's early days, so we'll see what it how it works. But I think again, I think the eye and the retina are leading the way for use of CRISPR-Cas9 overall for all of medicine. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, and you did a great job breaking that down. I feel I don't still fully understand it, but I understand it much better than I did about 2-3 minutes ago. And if you can make me understand it, then that you can make anyone understand it. So that's good. Yoshi, we had this conversation on the podcast recently, and I think Dan and I talked about this, and maybe I talked to a couple other people. Do you see potential disadvantages to permanent genetic manipulation in terms of treating androgenic disease, right? So we have a long track record with anti-VEGF, for example, but any of these therapies, let's say target VEGF as a target, are there disadvantages to permanently saturating the receptors of the anti-VEGF? Or are there disadvantages in terms of maybe they're, you know, for example, people talked in wet AMD, could this cause more atrophy? Are there disadvantages in terms of ischemia and diabetes? There's no evidence for any of these things. We also don't have any evidence of what happens when you permanently kind of alter the genetics. Because I think this is really exciting. I'm not here to be a wet blanket. But one of the things we always have to talk about with future directions is, well, what are kind of potential downsides of this therapy?
Yeah, great points. And, you know, just the comments on Dan's explanation of CRISPR, I kind of feel a little smarter just listening to him. So I really appreciate that. And regarding just permanent suppression of VEGF or any other cytokine, I think there are potential ramifications, but these targets are really well thought out. Also in gene retinal dystrophies, these are specific genetic defects that need to be corrected. So I think that really makes sense. Now we're talking next about the multifactorial vascular conditions like neovascular AMD, diabetic retinopathy, DME. And there, VEGF may play a homeostatic role, but we really don't know. We do know that it needs to be suppressed for better visual outcomes. And that's what matters most. In conducting these studies, I think it'll be very important to look at systemic safety also. Inflammation remains sort of an issue for a lot of our new modalities, especially intravitreal delivery of gene therapies seems to cause more inflammation compared to subretinal delivery, or more recently, suprachoroidal delivery seems like a very exciting way to do this too. And so it's not just about the, you know, the target. I think we do have to think of the entire eyeball, entire patient as well.
Right, right, great points. Dan, anything to respond to Yoshi or kind of talk about this conversation? Maybe you can reference also if you have any other thoughts about permanent kind of androgenic blockade, quote unquote permanent.
I think permanent gene editing may not necessarily be a good thing, just because it is a permanent change. We don't know what's going to happen long term. The other thing with, you know, these CRISPR technologies is that they can also have what are called off-target effects, in that they can edit other parts of the genome that you're not meaning to do it. So I think the jury's still out. You know, there are other therapeutics, for instance, that target the RNA, which don't cause these permanent changes, which has both good and bad parts. You know, if you're permanently altering it, it'll have a long-term effect versus other things like RNA, you may have to continually inject. Now, I just wanted to touch on one point that Yoshi made, which is the delivery techniques, and certainly the idea of, let's say, suprachoroidal injection of gene therapy vectors is certainly a very, very attractive method, especially for vectors that have been primarily delivered by subretinal delivery. And so I think that's very exciting to be able to just have gene therapy in the office, either through suprachoroidal or intravitreal injection. I think there's a couple of things with suprachoroidal injection. I think it's still very much in its infancy, so we'll have to see, you know, how does it compare in terms of inflammation and durability. And I think the big thing, which may not be so much the case for like anti-VEGF proteins, but because it's do we need to inject higher concentrations of the virus to get the same effect? And with that may cause additional inflammation. And I think also particularly relevant is for the inherited retinal diseases, where we're currently using subretinal delivery in a very small area. And the question is, you know, if we inject it suprachoroidally, can we even get a better effect? Do we need to have more of the vector? But again, all very, very exciting times, and it'll be very exciting to see the results of the upcoming studies.
Right. You know, and Yoshi, we're going to tie this a little bit into the conversation for the next article, which is Pearls for Pediatric Retinal Disease. And this is written by Luis Acaba Baracol, RV Paul Chan, one of our friends and one of your mentors, and Nina Baracol, also a friend and mentor to many of us. And the three diseases they kind of reviewed, and I would suggest anyone who has an interest in retina kind of look at this article, because it does a good job kind of very simply giving five pearls for each disease. And that's, you know, fever, Stickler syndrome, X-linked retinoschisis, chorioretinal coloboma, and persistent fetal vasculature. Yoshi, I'm going to ask you to make a hard call. These are all great pearls. If you had to pick three pearls out of the 25 pearls presented that you'd want a fellow of yours listening to take home with them, because they usually say people can't learn more than three things from any sort of given media, whether it's a lecture or a podcast, what are kind of the three biggest pearls that you read? You're like, you know what? That's something that every retina specialist sort of know if they're going to be seeing kids as part of their retina practice.
Okay, this is a tough one. You didn't tell me you were going to ask me this.
No, I wanted to be completely out natural.
So these are my personal pearls, and these are all kind of themes that you see when you read these wonderful pearls presented in this editorial. That's very common throughout all the five different disease conditions. And number one, I think that you have to kind of pause when you see a pediatric patient, because it's not just a small adult eye in terms of the pathophysiology, the anatomy, and the list of diagnoses. It's a little different. The mechanism of disease is different too. So when you see a younger patient, just like pause for half a second and kind of think about it, approach it differently. And number two, wide field angiography has taught us so much about these various conditions, whether it's ROP, fevers, incontinentia pigmenti, and many of these pediatric vitreoretinopathies will have peripheral manifestations. And so whether it's a red cam fluorescein during an EUA or an optose fluorescein or equivalent in clinic, wide field angiography gives you a lot of information, and it can really help you make clinch the diagnosis. And number three, I think a very nice pearl is you have the patient in front of you, but you have to think more outside of the eyeball. Think about the entire patient. Just kind of look at them. Do they look a little funny? Do they look syndromic? Look at their family and think about the family too. A very cheap way of doing genetic testing is examining the parents, whether it's by screening fluorescein or genetic testing or examining their eyes. And that itself will give you a lot of clues, especially when you're not sure. For example, a lot of times we're not 100% sure, is this Coats disease? Is this fever? If the patient has a history of prematurity a little bit, can this be a manifestation of mild ROP? Examining the family members will give you instantaneous answers. And we're in the genomic era, so genetic testing is more and more important. But number one, if the family's coming from far away and they may not be able to afford the genetic testing, although we do have many free panels now, which is great, but they're not the most sensitive tests. Examining the family members will go a long way.
Amazing. I, again, love those pearls. As an uneducated observer, I would say, you know, there's a lot, like you said, there's a lot of things that are common between the syndromes. And really, a lot of them come down, again, to family history and thinking about systemic history. There's sort of some specific ones with genetic testing. Those are kind of general good pearls because we're going to get more and more information, hopefully, over time with genetic testing about each of these conditions that were all defined phenotypically originally. But over time, and the phenotype has defined a lot of the lessons that have been passed on from generation of retina specialists to generation of retina specialists, how to deal with each of these conditions. But as our tools to treat these patients, but also test these patients get better, we're going to be defining these conditions more genotypically, and that's already started. Dan, I won't even pretend to offer anything of value compared to Dr. Yonakawa when it comes to pediatric retinal disease. I don't know if you have anything else to add regarding this or any of the tips that were shown here in this paper.
So I certainly do not. I certainly learned a lot. That was maybe my whole pediatric retina training right there. And perhaps I just wanted to ask Yoshi a question. And so I certainly admire anyone who does pediatric retina. I think they're the comprehensive retina specialist. As an adult retina specialist, I just play one on TV. But for the general retina specialist, I'm wondering if you had any pearls about adult manifestations of pediatric disorders in terms of a pearl, like let's say a patient who had retinopathy prematurity or some other pediatric condition that you'd like to pass on to all the adult retina surgeons.
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic. And all these kids become adults. And the phenotype gets a little muddy when they become older. And a lot of these patients may not have that pediatric retinal diagnosis when they initially present to an adult retina clinic. For example, you mentioned adult retinopathy of prematurity. And, this is something that we're going to be all seeing more and more of as the babies are becoming smaller and younger. The smallest babies are now surviving, and thankfully, but they will have retinal manifestations more commonly into adulthood as well. And when you examine these patients, a lot of these pediatric conditions are vascular in nature. And so if you see that the vessels are a little funny, I always ask about history of prematurity. And even if you find an OCT finding that's a little abnormal, like persistent inner retinal layers, but everything else looks pretty normal, I kind of ask, were you premature as a baby? And a couple of patients, they were like, wow, how on earth did you know? And so I think just keeping that, asking about prematurity in the back of your mind will help. And you have a lot of other conditions, though, which are more easy to identify. I think, for example, Coats disease, that's a lifelong disease too. And a lot of patients come in as adults with significant exudation out of nowhere. And in those cases, fluorescein will help. Wide field fluorescein will give you a lot of information here again, also in adult patients.
Amazing. And when we talk about adult retinal surgeons, Dan, we're not just talking about retinal surgeons who happen to be adults. We're talking about the retinal surgeons who take care of adults, because some of us have never lost the inner child inside, even as retinal surgeons. And with that awkward segue, we're going to move on to our next article, which is cryopreserved amniotic membrane for intravitreal injection. This is written by Atul Jain out of San Diego. And I'm just going to mention, you know, this was talking about the use of intravitreal injections and the idea of the ocular surface being affected, right? Because there's some question about this PrEP. You know, we all use aseptic PrEP, and many of us, most of us, use povidone iodine, and that can result in some issues in terms of the ocular surface. And a lot of patients may have corneal epithelial issues after injections, and I think we've all had patients who are sensitive. And this is an interesting concept, was how do you handle this? So Dr. Jain in this article is talking about how do you improve the ocular surface, right? And so they use this Procare MT made by BioTissue, and they started using these in eyes after injections. And they reported that there was an improvement in symptoms, and the late Paul Tornavi was involved in this project. You know, Dan, we used the Procare way back when for chemical burn patients. So we had some experience as residents using it. Many people are not using it, very familiar with the Procare and other options for amniotic membrane, such as dehydrated AMT or cryopreserved AMT. Either that can be stored at room temperature or is kept refrigerated. There are obviously benefits to this, and I don't think any of us disagree with the idea that probably a lot of patients will feel better with the Procare and the surface. But I almost wonder, I mean, how big a market there is for this, and how necessary is this? Are there other things we can kind of modify in the injection technique that would not result in this sort of ocular surface disease? So what do you do, Dan, for the patient you have that does have a lot of irritation, complains about a lot of irritation after injections? What are kind of your steps to improve that? What do you kind of change in your prep process maybe for that individual patient?
Yeah, you know, I would say just to take a step back, I think this brings up a really, really interesting idea, or still something that we haven't perfected yet. And I think that's really the patient experience with intravitreal injection. And that, you know, we don't have the perfect procedure where patients feel great afterwards and, you know, are completely satisfied. I mean, I think certainly from the efficacy of the treatments, you know, it's fantastic, but really that experience, particularly after the injection, this irritation, you know, as we all know, it's certainly a real thing, and it can have consequences not only for the patient, but also for potentially if the patient doesn't really like their experience with one physician, you know, they may switch physicians and such. And so, you know, I think there's a couple parts. One, as I mentioned in the article, there's a couple of places where this might be the case. One might be intraoperative things like the anesthesia, the injection itself, the needle that's used. But I think we all agree a lot of it is due to toxicity from povidone iodine or what other type of antiseptic that one uses. And I would say for the patient that's constantly that does complain afterwards, I always think an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So usually what I've been doing is actually I've switched over to minimizing the amount of betadine that I will use in my injection. Before I would, you know, douse the eye in betadine with a syringe, but now I just apply it very focally with a Q-tip and then add a drop afterwards. And I've certainly noticed an improvement in terms of the number of people who complain about irritation after intravitreal injection. Personally, I haven't done too much afterwards. Sometimes, like, I counsel patients, you know, you can use artificial tears that are refrigerated for some symptomatic relief. But those are the things that I've tried.
Great points, Dan. And I'll add a couple things. You know, I've had some experience for patients, I can think of a couple patients specifically. Well, obviously, I won't mention names for HIPAA purposes, but the conversation I've had with these patients is every single person is different. And yes, for 99% of the population, something might work. But for an individual patient, there may be things that just are more uncomfortable. And I've had patients, for example, I have a specific patient who basically, if she receives tetracaine or betadine, she basically can't see from the eye for 2 days. She has really, really bad superficial punctate keratopathy and dryness afterward. And she actually prefers to get her injections with just proparacaine as anesthetics, which to most patients sounds crazy because they don't feel they get enough anesthesia. But to her, that she doesn't feel any pain with that. And then she can see well after. And for the betadine, I do very similarly to what you do. I soak up Q-tip and betadine and directly apply it to that area before putting a final drop, allowing that to kind of evaporate and hopefully kill any microbacteria in that area. And then I have another patient, for example, who the first time I gave her an injection, she actually had a true anaphylactic reaction. We have a lot of patients who report iodine allergy. Well, this is a patient who actually had anaphylaxis, and we knew it had to be either the tetracaine or the betadine. And actually, what I do for her is similar. I use proparacaine. I don't use tetracaine. I just use a focal amount of betadine just in the spot. And she's had several injections now for both eyes over 2 years that have been necessary to prevent her from losing vision and simultaneously avoid anaphylaxis, which is a real and serious problem. So, Yoshi, I don't know what your approaches are to these situations. I think we all have had to be creative with certain patients. What other things, anything similar you do and anything additional you want to add in terms of tips or tricks to handle patients who may have a lot of surface issue after injections?
Yeah, so regarding pain, I think there's a factor of pain during the injection also. So I personally don't use a speculum. No one in my practice uses a speculum either. I think it hurts a lot and you're more likely to cause abrasions. And another pro I think is you really want to inject at where the pars plana is, at 3.5-4 millimeters, not closer. I think that there's a tendency to want to inject closer to the limbus because it looks safer, but it hurts more. And regarding the prep, usually all I do is one drop at the site of the injection, and I hold the lids myself, and I use one hand to drop the betadine, one hand to do the injection while I'm holding the lids myself. And then I do if the patient had issues afterwards, I do a rinse while I'm still holding a lid so that they don't close their eye and the betadine goes all over. If they still had pain, I would do an ointment afterwards. And I also ask the patients to use copious artificial tears the week before the visit so they come in with a more robust tear film. And I think MGD is something that's very underdiagnosed, but that should be treated very aggressively. So I'm always counseling patients about warm compresses and stuff. I think it's important for very severe cases to get cornea colleagues on board sooner than later, because I think the ocular surface issues are real. And in preparation for this discussion, I cheated a little bit, and I was really intrigued by the Prokera mechanism. And so I called Ziba Sayed, who both of you know really well, and she's one of our cornea colleagues, and she was telling me about how the membrane works with all the pro-healing, anti-inflammatory responses. And we were talking about it, and it's pretty expensive. So it's probably not going to be anything routinely that we do. But for severe patients, especially who have non-healing epithelial defects, there may be a role with it. But I think there are many things that dry eye specialists can do for these patients. So working in tandem is probably the best approach.
Awesome. And we're going to transition to this last article here, which is just a quick paper right up by Guneet Sodhi, Brittany Stotler, and Aaron Singh about choroidal melanoma versus peripheral exudative hemorrhagic choroid retinopathy, what people call PECHER or PECHER. PECHER is this peripheral retinal degeneration where you get pigment epithelial detachments, you can get choroidal neovascular membrane, subretinal hemorrhage, exudate, and you get these fibrotic lesions that develop in the periphery. Some people equate this almost to a discoform lesions of the macula in the periphery, and they can simulate when they're large or when they cause hemorrhage, it can simulate and cause concern for a possible choroidal melanoma. So they go through kind of different cases and how to tell these apart. They have a really nice table defining the differences, usually the bilateral findings in PECHER versus unilateral in choroidal melanoma. And then on ultrasound, the reflectivity, low to medium for a melanoma versus absence or low internal for PECHER. Sometimes high if there's an acute bleed, in which case it's a little more obvious it's not melanoma. And the multifocality versus unifocality. I'm curious, you guys are both kind of in practice. You have a little more specialized practice with pediatrics, but, I feel like I see, this is not that uncommon, Dan. I'll see a case or two every few months of this, and maybe it's more common in areas. I feel like I saw more cases up in the Northeast when I was up there for fellowship. But I think this is a pretty important thing. You know, the Shields had written about this is one of the most common, if not the most common thing that's confused for choroidal melanoma along with choroidal nevi. It's obviously a very important thing to distinguish because the treatments are very, very different and the prognosis is very, very different. Have you seen any of these out in practice in California?
You know, I've seen a few. I wouldn't say as much as the frequency that you are stating. So, I agree. I think certainly being aware of the entity and also that it's the most common masquerader, uveal melanoma, is really important. And I like, especially as the article said, you know, I think some of the biggest things, again, if there is the multifocality, I think certainly that's very helpful. You know, I think some of the things like the FA-ICG findings can be quite equivocal and also some of the ultrasound findings. So I still think it's can be a very difficult thing to differentiate. And I think if you're observing it after a couple months and it's not really quite as it should, I think certainly having an ocular oncologist take a look never hurts.
Yoshi, how about you? I mean, you're back in my old stomping grounds, but you were in Boston beforehand. Have you seen it? Well, then you were in Detroit, actually, before that. I mean, have you seen differences regionally, or it's been, again, just a kind of a trickle of these cases over time?
I'm not sure if there's a regional predisposition. That might be interesting to study, but I think it's definitely something that's very underdiagnosed, since these lesions tend to be peripheral. Most patients are asymptomatic until they bleed. And so I think the way these kind of patients present would be either a pseudomelanoma to the ocular oncology clinic, or when they present to us, oftentimes these patients come to me with severe vitreous hemorrhage. And I'm trying to figure things out and do the B scan, very important. And Dr. Singh's editorial made a great point about looking carefully at the B scan, make sure that the choroid is not involved. That's a great pearl. And in this piece, they have a really nice chart, so I encourage everybody to check it out. Which compares the two entities, melanoma versus pecker. I call it pecker, by the way. I don't know who's right, but yeah. And I think when we take these patients to the OR, there's a lot of heme, and then you see that peripheral hemorrhage. And a lot of times you consider, do you treat these patients with anti-VEGF afterwards or not? And if they have recurrent hemorrhages, I think that's indicated. And we have to be careful because these patients can also develop regmatogenous detachments afterwards.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, these can be tricky to treat, and definitely vitreous hemorrhage. I had a case when I was a fellow where I remember we went in and it was supposed to be just a vitreous hemorrhage, and maybe we weren't sure what was going on. Maybe it was an RVO, and it turned out there was a large subretinal hemorrhage breakthrough. These cases can be very, very tricky. And I would caution, like I said, usually the breaks are often micro breaks. And if you try to make a drain or anything to drain, it actually can result in a little more trouble. So, Dan and Yoshi, thank you so much for your time. I think we did a pretty good recap in about half an hour. Guys, I appreciate you taking the time as we head into November to do this. And hope you both have a wonderful night.
Thanks so much. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Jake.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye. As always, we can find this episode and all other episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. All 264 episodes, including this one, can be found there, sorted by category. In addition, you can find links to subscribe, as well as to receive updates on the latest episodes as they arrive, and those will be directly to your email inbox. I prefer to subscribe on my cell phone, so I use my smartphone and use the Apple Podcast app. There's a similar app for Android devices where you can find us. You can find us on Facebook or on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And to contact us, please email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Or you can contact us by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website. We love episode day ideas as well as things we can do better as we move forward through the rest of 2020 and into 2021. And we love the feedback we get with the reviews you leave in the Apple Podcasts and Android Podcast app. Thank you so much to Drs. Daniel Chow and Yoshihiro Yonakawa for joining me for this episode. Thank you to Jennifer Ford and the entire team at Pentavision for allowing us to preview this edition of Retinal Physician. Thank yous are due to Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Michael Venicasa, who handle all the production and social media accompanying this episode. Finally, listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's